Text for today then is Mark chapter 9, verses 30 to 37, and these are the words of God. They went on from there and passed through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days he will rise." But they did not understand the saying, and were afraid to ask him. And they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you discussing on the way?" But they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. And he sat down and called the 12 and said to them, "If anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all." And he took a child and put him in the midst of them. And taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me." Amen.
Good morning again. Keep that open in front of you. We'll work our way through it. I wonder if you've ever been the victim of a con. It's a horrible feeling if you have, and it makes you feel really stupid. And maybe you see other people victims of a con by a trickster or something at big level, smaller. The most sort of small thing is when you have. You see those guys on the street, in a city street somewhere, you've seen them, and they've got like little cups with a little ball, and they're having like some little bet, and you know which cup the little ball is under, and it'll tempt you to put money on it, and it isn't. That's impossible. So you play again, and he does it again, and before you know it, he's taken loads of money off you. And it's a con on a bit of a bigger scale. You hear these things, or maybe, sorry if you have, you've been a victim of it, you get these people who offer to invest your money in some sure investment that's going to be absolutely fantastic, and before you know it, the money's just disappeared to nowhere, as has the person. It's just absolutely horrible, isn't it? You feel so stupid, gone without a trace. Yeah. There's an even bigger con going on, and it's to do with the whole of life. So what it is, you can live your life for something, give yourself for something, running, chasing it, only to find you were heading in completely the wrong direction. It wasn't what life was about at all. You see people living for these promises of pleasure or, you know, wealth, comfort, perfect health, all those kind of things. And at the end, they were just chasing a shadow. But here's the real sting this morning. Churches can do that too. They can fall for a lie that says, this will make it great. This will be a great church. And so why Mark included this little bit in his account of the gospel of Jesus Christ? It's for us. There's kind of two bits to it, to avoid the con and to get real life. Two bits that were very hard lessons for these disciples there with Jesus at the time. They didn't get it at the time. Now, most people think that Mark, who wrote it, was some sort of like a sidekick to Peter. And so a lot of this is seen through Peter's eyes. And I can imagine old Peter, aged Peter, talking to Mark and trying to get this right and help him get this all down. And he's going through this bit with Mark, and he pauses and he says, "Boy, that was a hard one to get. We could not see that at the time. We just didn't get it. We were slow. Everything in us didn't want to hear what Jesus was saying to us on that day." And he looks ahead into this sort of imaginary distance through his old eyes, and he says, I fear for the churches. I fear for the churches of the future, because it's going to be a very hard one for them to get to. And the two lessons boil down to something like this. Humbly listen and humbly serve. I think that's it. It sounds so simple, but look, let's play the episode through and see if you kind of get the gist of that. So here we are, verse 30. They went on from where? Well, I believe you've been working this through week by week. After the transfiguration, that amazing glimpse of Jesus in glory, they've come down to earth with a bump. And there's that awful situation, that demon-possessed boy and their complete powerlessness to do anything about this situation, the ugliness of life on earth, hopeless without the power of God. But Jesus now, what he wants is to get away from all the crowds. He just wants to be alone with his disciples. He wants to take them away. They passed through Galilee and he did not want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples. He could have bathed in glory, having done the thing that nobody else could do, you know. But he's already taught them this lesson back in chapter 8, where he said, it's the cross now, it's carry your cross now. Glory is later. They just needed to humbly listen to what he had to say. It's such a big deal. Just humbly listen, right? Sometimes, well, look, I don't know most of you. I've met some of you before, but I can speak on behalf of our own church, and I guess some of this will resonate with you, but sometimes we just want to know how to build the church, how to make it better, how to make it bigger, how to reach others, how to bring them in, how to persuade them, or we need to know, well, what does our church need for the next phase of its life? Where are we going? We need this kind of wisdom, and we read from the Proverbs earlier. Yeah, wisdom, best thing above all things, and but you know what Jesus teaches here is it's like this vital lesson in priorities. Or the priority. If you don't get this, you won't get anything. All that wisdom will count for nothing if you don't get this point. And what is it that's so important? It's what he's already said to them before, but human nature is slow to believe it. We hear it, we go, yeah, sure, but we haven't taken it in. The Son of Man is going to die. He looks them in the eye and he says it again, as clearly as he can. The Son of Man, that's me, he says, the Son of Man is going to suffer. He's going to suffer, not in a glorious way like Rambo or Gladiator or one of those sort of things. He's going to be placed into human hands, delivered into the hands of men. I wonder what you thought of the men Jesus might be referring to when you think back of what you've seen through Mark's gospel so far. Who are the people who've taken against Jesus most? Who have been the ones who've kind of would like to get their hands on him? And it's so unthinkable, isn't it? Just these nasty people, the religious fanatics and the like, just, ugh, imagine them getting the better of Jesus. What a horrible, horrible thought. He'll be given to them. They will have power over him. So why do you think these disciples, when you look back to those early chapters of Mark, why do you think those disciples followed Jesus? Like, I know they were compelled by Jesus, compelled by the power of God and all that, but what was actually going on in their minds through that process where they said, yeah, we'll leave everything and follow this man? What? They saw somebody in him with such power and just something about him, something better, something hopeful, right? Something just out of this world, perhaps. They saw somebody who was offering them real exciting life. And that's why they followed Jesus. And there's been ups and downs, but it has been exciting for them, hasn't it, in this process. And they've now discovered a chapter ago, He's the Messiah. It's dawned on them. He's the one the world's been waiting for, our people have been waiting for from the beginning. And now, at this moment, he's saying to them, he's going to be delivered into the hands of men. And these men are going to do to him what they want. They're going to kill him. And then he says, after he's been killed, after 3 days, he will rise again. But verse 32, they just looked at him like he was talking foreign. And you can understand them, can't you? You ever been in a conversation with somebody who's foreign and you just haven't got a clue what they're saying? okay, here's my confession. My worst ever holiday was in France. Lindsay, my wife, had a French pen pal when she was growing up, and they spent every summer together, one place or the other. Anyway, I went to Toulouse, beautiful Toulouse, for a week with this girl, Elodie, and her boyfriend, they weren't Christians, her and her boyfriend, Nicola. That was a problem to me already, boyfriend Nicola. He played rugby for Toulouse. And the whole week was just horrible. It was this kind of just racism against me, basically, the whole week from beginning to, oh, this is an English weather, this is English food. Oh. And it was just, it was relentless and horrible. And the final evening, we'd been invited to this lovely meal with some other people, and my hostess had kind of latched onto me, this older woman, and she was just talking to me incessantly across this long meal, all the way through, just talking to me, and I couldn't understand a word she was saying, and she was going on and on throughout this whole long, disgusting meal. So I shouldn't be so rude. It was their local specialty. It was horrible. And by the time pudding came, she was looking me in the eye and saying the same thing over and over and over, and I was like, I don't talk French. And she was saying the same thing slower and louder, and then I realized she was saying, I am speaking English. And she'd been speaking English the whole time. I had no idea. And these disciples are just like, Jesus, you're talking. But it doesn't make sense. They don't want to ask. They don't want to ask. They're scared. And I would guess from experience, the reason's obvious in their case, even if it's just a little bit complicated in terms of like the human mind, your psyche. But I think you'll understand when you just pause on it for a minute, what's going on that stops them wanting to ask? They didn't want to ask because they don't really want to get into a conversation that's going to hurt their brain. Jesus is saying something big here. And from their point of view, they kind of get how the world works. They get life now. Even following Jesus, they kind of get it. And now Jesus is going to do that thing where he challenges everything and throws it all on its head. And they haven't got the headspace for this. They don't want what he's saying to go anywhere because it's kind of unsettling. And, you know, we're like that by nature, right? We'd rather think about things the way we do. Even as Christians, I've got this now, okay. I know how it works. I don't want another thing that's going to throw it all up in the air for me and make me have to think everything again. I just, got enough going on. We'd rather think about things the way we do. And even though he's talking about something, he's obviously talking about something that's central to their life and eternity. It's going to mean living differently, as we'll see in the coming verses. But again, just don't want to hear that. You don't want to come to church and be told everything you're doing is wrong. Turn around. It's just exhausting, isn't it? So these disciples, they've got a kind of, it's like an inability to understand that the Christ must die before rising. It's an inability, but it's a willful moral incapability. The way they're made up just makes them incapable of wanting to know what Jesus says. That's it. Just like last week, they couldn't heal the boy and fix the problem. Now they can't even ask Jesus to explain about his death. Now they just can't. I wonder if you can sort of put yourself in their shoes, you know? Now, okay, Mark, the author, he hasn't yet explained to us why Jesus has to die. As a reader, you get to this point and you should be asking the question, well, actually, they should have asked, please tell us, what does he mean? How do we understand the saying? And, you know, we'll keep reading, you'll keep reading as a church together, and that will become clearer. But for now, it shows something disturbing about ourselves, about us. Back in chapter 8, when Jesus said he was going to die, he said he would be killed. And now he puts it slightly differently. He says, they will kill. It's very active, very kind of slightly scarier the way he phrases it. And in chapter 8, he said it was the elders. It's just across the page in my Bible anyway. The, the elders, the priests, the scribes, they're going to do it. Now he says it's just men, generally, vaguely, all right? And there's something quite disturbingly universal. I don't know how you feel about that. Men, mankind is going to kill me, he says. And you might just have that niggling question as you're reading this through for the first time ever. That niggling question, well, does that include us somehow? It's just broader than the scribes and Pharisees and all that. Now, just allowing that thought to sit for a moment, it undoes us at a very deep level, I think. Undoes the things that we value. Okay, you know, I'm going to try and speak on behalf of your church, even my sort of guesswork. Okay, we have good teaching. We have good theology. We understand good theology. We live decent lives. We bring up our children well. We value these things. We killed Jesus. And that's the sort of point they have to listen to. And it's really unpleasant, isn't it? That's us. We killed Jesus. Kind of pricks the bubble of thinking you're something, doesn't it? As people, as Christians. And you can see why they were afraid to ask. There's something else as well, just on this bit, just before we sort of rush on to the next bit. But Jesus doesn't say who is going to deliver him over. He says he's going to be delivered. And again, it's not stated. Someone, something, someone is going to deliver him over to men. But if it's to men generally, universally, the question might come into your head, does he mean somehow God is going to hand him over? Is that what he's on about? Could it be? And even if you don't get all that at this stage, the thought has to cross your mind that there is something enormous going on with what Jesus is talking about. Earlier in the chapter, you'll remember this if you were here, whenever you looked at it, but that voice of God came to three of Jesus' disciples on the mountain and said, "This is my son, listen to him." It's a clear instruction, isn't it, from God himself, listen to him. Well, now he's talking about some cosmic handing over, and the disciples, they just don't get it at all. What's happening? It's just so far above them. And I think it's worth us from this just bearing in mind this enormous gap, this huge chasm between the things of God and the things we understand and can get our heads around. Look, even if you see yourself as smarter than the average person, smarter than the average Christian, smarter than these disciples, right? This sort of intellectual pride, especially theological intellectual pride that's so natural to us, it's a very foolish thing, isn't it, when you think about that? You know the book of Job in the Bible? You know that one? I think one of the points of the book of Job, it's the story of the man who's suffered as badly as anybody's ever suffered. And you know from the beginning what God's up to. You're given that little insight, but he's not. And his friends come and talk to him. And I think it's quite easy to read through that book. And this is what I've been taught from this book before. And I've read it this way myself, but you kind of read it as these friends are just giving him bad advice or bad theology. But actually, you read it more carefully and you find, just a minute, what they're saying, they're pretty good theologians, actually. And do you know this? I looked this up the other day. The book of Job is quoted twice in the New Testament directly, twice. And one of those quotes, 50%, one of those quotes is, guess what? It's from one of his friends. And the New Testament says that's scripture. It was good theology. It was good advice. So the issue isn't that they're giving him bad advice. It's not that they should have known better. The problem is that when it comes to the things of God, Like even the best of us know pretty much naff all, right? Which he's told us what we need, which is a lot, but it doesn't mean we know a lot compared to the things of God, does it? We just don't. It simply means we've got to get our priority right. What have we got to do? Humbly listen. That's all we've got in this world. Humbly listen. Because unless you know what he says, you know nothing. That's all we've got. Okay, second half. And you can see the point. It's humbly serve. And this is what these disciples had to learn and what we've got to learn. But how does Jesus reach the point? Let's join them again in verse 33. Okay, you there in verse 33? They arrive where they're staying, good old Capernaum, and they sort out their stuff or whatever as they're sort of arranging their luggage or maybe getting some food on or however it works. Jesus just asks this kind of casual but devastating question. So, what were you guys chatting about on the way here? And of course, again, silence, rigid silence from them all. They just stop in their tracks. They don't want to be asked. Well, they didn't want to be asked about the being killed thing. That was too much for their heads, too much for their hearts. And now they definitely don't want to answer this very simple question because they were chatting about who was the greatest. Get a bunch of guys together. Who was the greatest? Actually, the two issues are really connected. Jesus' death and their ego, absolutely bound up together. They don't get their need for Jesus' whole different view of what has to happen because they're still playing their let's pretend game of thinking they are something. They are still living in the con of life. Still believing it. Anyway, they've been exposed now by this question, and there's times when you just don't want to talk about something, right? There's times when you're asked a question and you just don't want to. I think the psychiatrists and people have a word for that. They call it shame. I don't want to be exposed here. And I was trying to think, what's this like? We've got a guy in our church who's the spitting image of Lionel Messi. Could you know who that Lionel Messi is? Yeah, he's kind of forgotten already, isn't he? Funny how things fly. He's a very famous footballer. He is a very famous footballer. He's really good. And it just occurred to me how on our Monday night football that some of our guys play, how different the conversation in the pub afterwards might be if it actually was Lionel Messi there, not just Rob, our guy from church. And I can imagine him, you know, the guys are sitting around having a drink and he comes back out the toilet and says, what are you talking about, guys? And there's silence. It's awkward now because then one of them points at the other and goes, he was just saying he could do more keepy uppies than any of us. And they all cringe. And then he goes, well, he was saying he could take on anyone in a one-on-one situation. He could skill out any of us. Don't tell him that. And it's that sort of feeling. And here the disciples face to face with Jesus. So, guys, what were you talking about? I don't know, after that silence, they didn't want to talk about it. I just wonder if what Mark hasn't mentioned is one of them points to the others and goes, well, those three, they were talking about how they were up the mountain with you and it was so amazing, they're not even allowed to talk about it. And they go, well, they were all saying they were down in the valley doing the real work, getting their hands dirty like real disciples while we were having a great time. Who's the greatest? And Jesus is like, right, teaching room now, and gets them all sat down. And he starts a point he's going to keep going on about till the end of the chapter. In fact, you might argue right into chapter 10 as well. But as far as today's bit's concerned, there's a basic point. And then having made his basic point, Jesus grabs a passing child. And to illustrate what this needs to look like, the basic point sums up the stuff about his death and what it means to follow him. Here it is. Here's the basic principle of what he teaches them. To be first, you've got to be last. Now, it's going to need some explaining, isn't it? Because that's just really odd, really strange thing to say. But just see what he's not saying before we look at it Jesus is not saying, how dare you want to be great? What a terrible thing to want to be great. It's not saying you should rather celebrate your failings. Everybody try and be rubbish. He's not saying that. This is not a race to the bottom. This is not a denial of human ambition or, you know, desire to achieve. He's just saying you've got it all completely back to front because you don't know what it means to follow me. You just don't get it. You don't understand about my death and what that means for you. And verse 36, the child, he plonks the kid in the middle of the circle, and then with this great gesture, he scoops him up in his arms. And verse 37, what does it mean to be last, to be the servant of all? It means welcoming the least, the smallest, like this. Welcoming that person. So here's the steps of logic. Hello. Here's the steps of logic. You receive, you welcome, you serve a little one like this. Okay, you receive that person, and Jesus says, you receive me. You receive that person, you receive me. And if you receive me, you receive my Father, the Lord God. Okay, play that back again in the negative. Just to try and get our heads around it. Okay, fail to serve the lowest one. Think about the lowest one in a minute. Okay, but you fail to serve the lowest one, and Jesus says, you fail, you haven't received Jesus. Wow. And if you haven't received Jesus, you haven't received God the Father, you're not saved. It's very black and white, isn't it? Very stark. You are not saved. How does that make sense? So think it through. Okay, if you think these people, whoever they are in your mind, if you think these people are beneath you, then you think you're something. If you think you're something, you won't think you need the cross. You'll say the words, you'll go through the motions, all that. You won't think you need the cross. If you don't think you need the cross, you won't cry out to Jesus for mercy. If you don't cry out to Jesus for mercy, you don't receive salvation. You're not saved. It's very big, isn't it? The point is, as Jesus sits there with his disciples at this point, he's sitting there, and the disciples, he creates this huge and this, well, actually very simple, but huge challenge for the church and for us as individuals. Who do you receive? Who do you accept? Who do you welcome? Okay, I'm going to say something that's really going to impress you, okay? In our church, we've had murderers and prostitutes. And whenever I say that, people go, oh, wow, that sounds like, wow, really cool church. That's the sort of church that Jesus would have had, right? They're the kind of people Jesus would have had. And yes, it is very cool, especially when they've got very big personalities, and they're the kind of people that you can have for a testimony to give to everybody else. And everybody goes, wow, yeah, church is really cool, right? Christianity is really cool. Look at them. They're the cool stories. Everyone thinks the church is cool. The gospel is cool. And you can wheel these people out of your events. You can include them in a chapter of your book with cool stories of life stories. Except, by the way, when that person falls away, 2 years on, 3 years on, or slips back into their old ways, and maybe they did that partly because you put them on a public platform and thrust them into leadership positions because you thought a great testimony like that is the number one qualification for leadership in the church. And when they fall, we stop talking about them because it's not cool anymore. Here's my confession on all this stuff. What I want for our church, what I want in our church, by the way, thank you all for praying for us a little while ago. What I want in our church is I want people who are capable of leading and taking responsibility and doing things. I want people who can increase the potential of our church to grow. I want people who are articulate and attractive in the way they relate to people. And I want people who can quickly grow into mature people in the faith. People I enjoy being with as well, by the way. I want those ones. And if you share any of that confession in your own head, what do we do with the people who are ugly and repulsive, people who don't wash, the people who smell of urine, The people who, when they speak to you, have a massive load of spit in the corner of their face, and actually it's not worth listening to them anyway. They've got absolutely nothing to say because their whole life is about the TV dramas that they've sort of taken into their own generations of depravity in their own existence. What do you do with them? And people like that turn to Christ. They are miraculously transformed. But that miraculous transformation can take a lifetime. It can take generations. Yeah, so it's tricky, isn't it? Because the church should be holy and pure. We should grow in knowledge and obedience. We should shine like stars in a dark world. That's absolutely right. Of course we should. We should be training up leaders. We should be doing those things, creating people of good character in one another. All those things, demanding godliness in the church. But what does it mean now to receive the little ones? What's it saying to us? What's it saying about us? When in practice, we don't. What does it say when we don't? And we don't because we've set up our church in such a way that it's just impossible for those people to ever be part of it. It's very hard, isn't it? Look, I know there's loads of churches that beat themselves up and say, well, we haven't got enough poor people, we haven't got enough dysfunctional people. You have who you have, right? That's it. You have who God gets you. You can't go and make them come in. But it's a question of attitude. And when confronted by little ones, do you serve or do you dismiss? And serving's very costly, isn't it? I love it that his example of the little one is a small child. A small child is very costly, as any parent knows. And you love that child because it's your own. What if it's not your own? What if it's not somebody you naturally owe anything to, actually, by right? Do you serve or do you dismiss? I hope you're feeling how a little passage like this cuts us wide open. It really does, doesn't it? Our hearts are exposed. We want to be great. And I want you all afterwards to say, oh, thank you. What a great talk. I want people to think I'm great. And so do you. It's the way we're wired. But we've got it all back to front, haven't we? You know that if anyone would be first, he must be last thing. It's not being the kind of classic primary school teacher of on sports day. You know, everybody hold hands and let's cross the finishing line together. There's no winners, no losers here. We're all fine. It's not that. It's not some kind of riddle. Oh, how can the first be last? Oh, sort of something the Buddha might have said. It's a simple point. He's saying, great, be first. Be first. The problem is you're running in the wrong direction. You're running towards the wrong finishing line. You've fallen for the con. Because greatness as you see it, it's missing the whole point of who you are. And you see the implication here. He's got the little one in his arms and he's saying, actually, you are the little ones. You need saving. You need somebody to serve you. You need me to serve you by dying for you. And you haven't got it. You're living in denial of the whole thing by pushing yourself above the others. Who's the greatest indeed? What on earth are they thinking? Who's the greatest? You think it's about getting your head above the others and pushing other people down or, you know, proving yourself in some way, like you're better. Sure, you know, work at your business, make your family the best, do things that are right to do, all that kind of stuff. But when it comes to people, the challenge is not how can I better them? It's how can I go to serve them? What can I do to serve them? How do you relate then to the weird kid, right? The mental people, the unattractive. What do you do with them? And we love to exalt ourselves and we naturally oppose simple faith. We naturally oppose going in the opposite. We naturally do go in the opposite direction to Christ and his cross that lays down ourselves for others. The crucified servant, because, you know, the con is so convincing. It's so convincing. It says you can be something. You can make it your way. You can, You can achieve something. You can make yourself great as a group. You can make yourselves great. You can go somewhere. But it's sin, that, isn't it? It's sin. Humility is what Jesus is calling his disciples to. And through Mark, writing this down, is what he's calling us to this morning. Humility. Humbly listen, humbly serve, and receive that forgiveness.